from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, why so many Medi-Cal patients who don't need emergency care are going to hospital ERs. Also, local Olympian Stephanie Brown Trafton, her hometown of Galt, honors her today for her gold medal in discus. And a Zen priest explains how Homer's Odyssey is a metaphor for the spiritual path. First, what's going on with California's budget, now 58 days late? And how about state lawmakers and the party conventions? Are they staying or going? Joining us with details on these and other California political stories is KXJZ's Capital Bureau Chief Marianne Russ. Marianne, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
How close are we to a state budget?
Well, I wish I had a working crystal ball to answer that one for you. It's really still a guessing game at this point. Everyone in the Capitol community is kind of in limbo. What we do know is lawmakers seem to be as much at an impasse as ever. Just a couple of days ago, the Democratic Assembly Speaker told reporters that no deal was ready to, quote, pop up anytime in the next few days. In fact, the Republican Assembly Leader, Mike Vallines, told me last week he was just plain mad. He's ready to be done and go home. This stalemate, Jeffrey, is still over the same issue, which is how to fill this $15 billion hole in the budget. It's boiled down to Republicans still say no to new taxes. Democrats won't cut $15 billion out. Democrats do want to raise taxes. The governor's talked about a temporary sales tax hike, and the Republicans want budget reform or a spending cap that restricts future state spending. And so far, they just have not been able to agree. Something that they have kind of turned back to, it's been up for discussion several times throughout this budget stalemate, is so-called borrowing. In this case, we're not talking about what you might think of typically as borrowing, but more borrowing money from other state programs, so money that voters have earmarked. For example, the most common one is for transportation dollars for local government. That's something that counties and cities are just livid about because they're strapped for cash, too. But today, during an event in Los Angeles, Governor Schwarzenegger reminded everyone he won't support a budget that includes such borrowing.
Borrowing more money is irresponsible. And we've heard the example about the credit cards, because it is like a family taking credit cards and overextending then to get another one to pay all of the debt off with that credit card. It doesn't solve any problems. It is not the solution. It is a disaster. It is not fair to local government. It's not fair to the people of the cities and the counties. It is not fair to transportation to go in that direction once again.
Well, obviously, Governor Schwarzenegger doesn't seem to like the idea very much. Who in the Capitol is calling for this kind of borrowing?
Well, I think it's seen as kind of a last resort. Speaker Bass hasn't exactly said she's a fan, but some Democrats have talked about it. However, Senate President Pro Tem Don Parada has said he's also against it. In fact, he quipped to someone that he'd stay till Thanksgiving if it meant avoiding that kind of borrowing. But it seems to be a little more palatable to Republicans because they're very much looking to avoid a tax increase. So it may be losing some steam, especially given the fact that the governor does have to sign any budget, and he's taking a pretty firm stance against it.
The state budget is late most years. How close are we to a record late budget?
I would say within spitting distance, Jeffrey. Sunday is the latest date that the legislature, that's August 31st, has ever passed a budget. September 5th is the latest date the governor has signed one. So pretty soon here, we're going to be in uncharted waters for the state of California, and that is saying a lot.
Typically, do reporters start to get a sense that there's a buzz around some deal several days before something happens? And is there any sign of any buzz like that at the Capitol?
You know, sometimes there is a feeling, Jeffrey. It's kind of a vibe. It's something that you can't really put your finger on. You hear a rumor here and there. This year has been a little bit different, though, because there have been a couple of times when we've felt that maybe something was moving, and it just hasn't. So at this point, we're ready to drop everything within, 20 minutes notice for a budget vote. It's been that kind of a year.
Earlier in the summer, the governor tried to put pressure on the legislature by saying that he wouldn't pass any bills until there was a budget. But he reneged on that earlier this week.
He did. In fact, he sent a letter to lawmakers, and he basically said, look, there's four measures that I will sign if you send them to me. And those are the ones that would need to get on the November ballot. Therefore, if he waits until there's a budget to sign them, most likely they won't make that November ballot. The four that he talked about is the first one, a high-speed rail measure. In fact, he signed this one last night. It updates the language of the high-speed rail bond that's on the November ballot. That's Proposition version one. It makes a few changes, calls for more oversight and more flexible spending. So that one's a done deal. The other three, a lottery modernization proposal. It's not really a bill yet, but it's part of the budget talks. Budget reform. And in this case, he's talking about a rainy day fund, kind of a bigger savings account for the state. And he also wants a mid-year cut authority. So the authority to cut programs by a certain percentage if revenues are coming in less than expected. And the last one is a water bond. As you've probably read and know about, he's been pushing for this for some time.
Yes. I read earlier today that the Fresno Bee editorial board said that he told them that he's not going to settle for a bad budget and would be willing to wait until the new year. Any reason to think that the governor is being serious in that? He does have a history of blowing smoke.
Oh, Jeffrey, I hope he's not serious. although I guess we'll have a lot of news stories to cover. It is interesting, though, to note that as I mentioned earlier, Senate President Pro Tem Don Parada made a similar comment about staying until Thanksgiving rather than doing this internal borrowing. So, you know, back when in May when Don Parada said, well, you know, we're going to miss the conventions because we're going to be finishing the budget, we all kind of thought, oh, well, probably not. Well, so who's to say?
Well, and speaking of the conventions, this is the political high point of the 4 years for people like lawmakers and governors to head off to the Democratic and Republican conventions. The Democratic convention is going on this week. The Democrats at the legislature, many of them had planned to go, but then earlier this week, the Assembly Speaker Karen Bass said, "You got to be back here on Wednesday."
Yeah, originally there was a session planned just for Monday and Friday, but they changed that up and also scheduled sessions for today and Thursday. It's interesting, Jeffrey. I think it was a tough image question for a lot of people. In the end, far fewer went than had actually planned to go. There were dozens, of course, who wanted to attend. Most opted not to. We confirmed that about five lawmakers did. Several of them flew back in time for session. They took red-eye flights just to make a speech and come back. Others said they were on standby at the convention. In case anything broke with the budget, they'd be back within a couple of hours. We did talk with one assemblywoman, Democrat Patty Berg, who decided not to go. She said she's disappointed, but she just didn't think it was right.
It was just an ethical call on my own. It wasn't because I was worried that I'd take a hit in the press. Really, it wasn't. It was that I couldn't justify it. I just couldn't justify leaving the state when we didn't have a budget. As much as I would have liked to have been there. And, you know, I was a Clinton delegate. So, you know, it would have been a wonderful opportunity to cheer Obama on and talk about Democratic unity and all of that. And of course, there are going to be some fabulous and wonderful speakers, and I would have enjoyed hearing all of them.
Governor Schwarzenegger was scheduled to, or is scheduled, I guess, to be a primetime speaker at the Republican convention on Monday. Is he going to go?
Well, I'll let him tell you. Here's what he had to say.
I made that clear that if we don't have a budget, I will not go to the Republican convention. Although, like I said, I feel very honored that I was given to open up the convention on Monday. But I think that to work for the people of California and to solve this budget problem is the most important thing right now for me.
Okay. So remind us, Marianne, what, if anything, is happening this week to move things towards a budget?
Well, it's interesting, Jeffrey, because a lot is happening this week apart from the budget. If you don't mind a quick digression,
please.
It's the last week of session. So lawmakers are meeting most days. In fact, the Assembly every day but one and the Senate every day. And there's even talk of weekend session just to what they call work the file. So this is that last chance of the session for lawmakers to get their bills through. So at the same time, we're having these budget talks. Lawmakers are also churning through, you know, hundreds of bills on any and every topic. And it's really interesting because Governor Schwarzenegger, as we mentioned earlier, made this threat not to sign any bills. He has until the end of September to make good on that threat. He would have to then veto them all if there is no budget by the end of September. Now, it's anyone's guess as to whether there will be a budget by then. I think most people assume there will be. But it's also will be interesting to note if that is the case, if he keeps that promise, given that he changed his mind about these few measures this week.
Okay. Marianne Ross, KXJZ Capitol Bureau Chief, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
This is Insight. Many of the people using California's ERs don't actually need emergency care, but you probably already knew that. But a new study has found that many of those people misusing the ER are not uninsured. They're Medi-Cal patients, meaning they do have health insurance. Joining us is the author of that study, Shannon McConville, a research associate at the Public Policy Institute of California and author of the study Emergency Department Care in California, Who Uses It and Why. Shannon, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, before we talk about the Medi-Cal patients, let's back up a little bit. Who is using emergency department care in California overall, and why?
Actually, the vast majority of the more than 10 million visits that happened in ERs in 2005 were made by insured Californians. As you mentioned, Medi-Cal does have the highest visit rate among everyone. We found that only about 15% or 1.5 million of those visits were made by the uninsured.
Why are Medi-Cal patients using ERs for non-emergency purposes?
Well, I mean, you know, there are probably a lot of different reasons, but one of them likely is a lack of alternative providers. There was a study that was done, and it's a few years old now, by some people at UCSF, but they found that just only about half of all physicians in California participated in the Medi-Cal program. So I do think that probably, you know, is affecting how often they're using the ER.
Remind us, please, what Medi-Cal is, who qualifies for Medi-Cal, what does it give them?
Sure. So Medi-Cal predominantly is used by low-income families. So there is an income cutoff, but there's also a categorical eligibility requirement. So you do, in general, need to have children in order to qualify for Medi-Cal. Now, Medi-Cal also does cover some people who are disabled and some other categories, but the largest group is those low-income children and families.
Roughly what percentage of the people who are going to the ER are there for an appropriate reason? In other words, that's exactly where they should be going to get the care that they need.
So we classified some things into what we called avoidable visits, and those were visits that could possibly have been treated in a different setting, whether a doctor's office or a clinic. And so we found that about 40% of all the visits to the ER could possibly have been avoided.
That sounds like a pretty large percentage.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would say that it is.
And is that a problem?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a problem to the extent that it does likely cost more to treat people, and other studies have looked at this. We didn't specifically get into cost issues in ours, but others suggest that to treat something in the ER that could have been treated in another primary care setting may cost up to 2 to 3 times more. So from that cost perspective, I think it's important, but it's also in terms of, you know, the continuity of care, and, you know, if people don't have access to other sources that may be more appropriate and they're not getting, you know, care in a timely manner and kind of managing certain things, it's less efficient and it's likely a lower quality of care.
We're talking about the use of emergency department care in California. It was the subject of a recent study by the Public Policy Institute of California. It found that Medi-Cal patients are heavy users of ERs and not necessarily for emergency purposes. Shannon McConville is a research associate at the PPIC and the author of the study. What about uninsured people? What percentage of the people at the ERs in California are uninsured, and why are they going to the ER? How often are they going to the ER for an appropriate reason, and how often are they going for a non-emergency reason?
Right. So, as I said, we estimate that about 15% of all of the ER visits in 2005 were made by those that were uninsured. And what we did find was that the uninsured had slightly lower rates of going for avoidable visits than Medi-Cal users, actually.
Okay.
Particularly amongst children.
Yes. What about immigrants? Are they heavy users of ERs?
So we did look at some issues about immigrants using, and we weren't able to use the hospital information that we had, which we used for another section, but we did use a representative survey of California adults. And what we found there was that immigrants were actually less likely to use the ER than native-born whites.
Do we know why that is?
I think there are probably, again, several different reasons. The uninsured may, you know, have different demographics than the rest of the population. I think they might be a slightly younger group. You know, some might say that they're a healthier group. That is one of the kind of the theory is this healthy migrant effect. They may have alternative places where they receive care, kind of maybe outside of the more mainstream medical community. I think there are probably several different reasons.
And children, are they heavy users of ERs?
Yes, they are. Actually, children 1 to 17, no, but infants are the highest users of ERs. And I don't think that would surprise really anyone, particularly parents. You know, if your baby gets sick in the middle of the night and is, you know, running a fever, then you're going to go to the ER. I mean, that's in many ways what they're there for.
Yes. Are we talking, for the most part, though, about actual emergencies? Or are we talking about just the most convenient or most practical place for someone to take their child for non-emergency care?
Well, so, yeah, for infants, they did have the highest rate of what we termed these potentially avoidable visits. About 7 in 10 of all visits for infants under 1 were in this avoidable category. And, you know, it could very well be related to a timely, you know, the hours and things. So, you know, in large part, you know, some of these other primary care sources aren't available in the evenings, particularly late at night or even on the weekends. And so, you know, if you lack other options and really feel like your child needs care, you're going to go to the emergency room.
Your study into emergency department care in California also listed 3 counties with the highest per capita emergency department visit rate. Which are they?
That's right. So those were Stanislaus, Fresno, and San Joaquin, all of which we, you know, are in the Central Valley region of the state.
And why would they have higher per capita visits to ERs?
Yeah, so we didn't look specifically at trying to, you know, understand exactly why that was, but we did take a look at some other, both demographic, but also provider characteristics of those counties. And one of the things that kind of jumped out was that those 3 counties had, relative to the state and also other counties, much lower per capita doctors. And so, you know, that may be contributing.
Why would that contribute?
Just not having those other available resources for healthcare in the community. You know, I mean, the ERs, they're a really important part of our healthcare system, but they are really just one part. And so to the extent that people are going for what we'll call these avoidable visits where they need treatment, I mean, that probably is an indicator that they, in part, don't have other good places to go. And so having fewer physicians means, you know, fewer opportunities to go to a doctor's office.
Shannon McConville of the Public Policy Institute of California has studied emergency department care in California, who uses it and why. Also with us is Ken Cohen, who's director of San Joaquin County's Healthcare Services Agency. Ken, welcome to Insight.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
How do you respond to Shannon McConville's findings? I assume you've been able to listen to our conversation.
Yes, and I've also had a chance to take a look at the report that they completed, and you know, I think they have identified some very important public policy issues, in regards to her conclusions regarding the Central Valley, we happen to agree that one of the biggest constraints that we have is that the shortage of physicians, which has been accentuated in areas like Fresno, San Joaquin, and Stanislaus, is really quite acute. We have almost half the number of physicians than you would see in urban areas of California.
Why is that? I mean, San Joaquin County is, to a certain extent, a fairly urban part of California. Stockton's a medium-sized city. It's very close to heavily populated areas. Why should San Joaquin County have about half the number of doctors that it would have compared to other parts of California?
You know, I'm only going to speculate somewhat on this, but physicians generally tend to reside in urban areas where they have higher reimbursements, opportunities to provide different level of amenities for their families. They often tend to reside fairly close to where they went to medical school. And as you know, there is no medical school in the Central Valley. Historically, although it hit the character, has changed quite a bit. The Central Valley has been viewed as somewhat of a more rural community than it is now. Okay, so we have been really lagging behind the rest of the state and for almost a decade.
So there's a shortage of doctors. Are there other characteristics of San Joaquin County that you see contributing to a high level of use of emergency care?
I think the demographics of our population is that we have high rates of unemployment. We have high rates of coverage through the Medi-Cal program. We certainly have some very unusual issues to deal with seasonally in terms of agriculture and growing, a number of migrant populations, and generally other demographics, poverty, education. The Central Valley has lagged behind the rest of California.
My guest is Ken Cohen, director of San Joaquin County's Healthcare Services Agency. Is it your observation and your colleagues at San Joaquin County, is it your observation that ER use does seem to be higher than it should be in San Joaquin County?
Well, you know, let me just make an observation. I do think that there is a high use of the emergency department, and certainly looking retrospectively, it's easier to make a judgment as to whether or not that care could have been done in another setting. But we do know that not having enough physicians, not having resources available in evenings and on weekends contributes to a higher use of the emergency room for primary care. This is not unusual. It's something that has been noted in many parts of the nation. And there are opportunities, we think, for public education. There are certainly opportunities for other strategies that we are working on. Certainly, again, there are significant implications. It is much higher cost to treat patients in an emergency room than in other settings. And as was pointed out earlier, it is a better environment for primary care and continuity of care to have a personal physician who is familiar with you and your family. So we are working with a number of community agencies, with state agencies and schools and other groups to try to address expanding access to care.
Does the relatively heavy use of emergency care in San Joaquin County affect the resources that are available for other kinds of health care in the county?
I would say that, the resources that we have, at least from the public sector, are frankly quite scarce. It certainly is contributing to impeding access. The latest reductions in Medi-Cal reimbursement to physicians has literally pushed, we think, more people towards the emergency rooms than should be. We think from a policy perspective that may be, penny-wise and dollar-foolish. Unfortunately, because of those policy actions at the state level, the burden has really been shifted to the county to sort of fill the gap. And we do that both through the provision of emergency services and also through a large public network of primary and outpatient specialty clinic services. So in addition to our emergency room, we provide almost 130,000 visits for primary obstetrics, pediatrics, and specialty care on an outpatient basis. Mm-hmm. And we really try to encourage patients, even when they're seen in the emergency room, to be seen in follow-up and to continue to use the clinics as a more appropriate resource.
Let's go back to Shannon McConville of the PPIC. Shannon, give us a recommendation or two that you would make to policymakers and to health officials in California to smooth out the use of ERs?
Well, and we've been talking about that kind of throughout. Thinking about ERs as being this, very, very important part of our system, but only, just one part, and kind of thinking about the availability of alternative sources of care and whether that means expanding access to clinics and maybe their hours, and putting more money into those systems. I know in the Inland Empire, their Medi-Cal managed care programs to try to kind of lower some of the reliance of Medi-Cal users on the ER have, you know, recently gone about trying to make some relationships with urgent care clinics and doing a big public education campaign to try to move people from the ER to these urgent care clinics, and kind of really highlighting, look, it could be faster, it could be closer to your home, you could wait less, and you know, so there, I think it's thinking about these other possible sources of primary care and quality care that might help reduce some of the burden that our mm-hmm. that our ERs are under.
And Ken Cohen, anything that you would like to say to lawmakers and the governor that would help, in your opinion, to smooth out ER use in counties like San Joaquin?
I actually agree with Shannon that expanding resources for things like expanded clinic hours, urgent care, other approaches. We've looked at expanding the use of nurse practitioners, physician assistants, looking at their practice privileges to see if they could do more services. Ultimately, the state is going to have to address the number of physicians, certainly in the Central Valley. Very difficult for us to expand clinic hours and to expand urgent care when we are having enormous difficulties attracting physicians just to meet our basic needs, and we can't do that at present.
Yes. And finally, just very quickly, Shannon, notwithstanding everything we've been talking about heavy use of ERs in some parts of California, overall, the use of ERs in California actually declined over the last few years.
Well, actually, it declined slightly per capita. It stayed relatively steady in terms of the total number of aggregate visits, which has hovered right around just over 10 million for the last 5 years here in California.
And that's because, I mean, we've been hearing about heavy use in some parts of the state.
Sure, and that's not, you know, kind of looking at different visit rates kind of throughout, although we did look at different visit rates in a per capita way throughout the state, and those do vary quite a bit. But yeah, in terms of just the aggregate statewide numbers, we stayed pretty steady in terms of the total volume, although we do have a lot fewer ERs that are in operation over the last 10 years. So, you know, the number of visits per ER still in operation has gone up. So volume has increased despite kind of a stabilization in the total number of visits.
Good. Well, thank you both very much. Shannon McConville at the Public Policy Institute of California and Ken Cohen at San Joaquin County's Healthcare Services Agency. I appreciate you both joining us.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Congratulations, Shannon. That's a very nice report.
Thanks so much.
The report is, by the way, is called Emergency Department Care in California, Who Uses It and Why? You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, local Olympian Stephanie Brown Trafton, her hometown of Galt, honors her today for her gold medal in discus. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can get a daily RSS feed telling you what's on the next edition of Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. One of the most memorable gold medals for the U.S. in this year's Olympics was the gold in women's discus. Stephanie Brown Trafton's win was especially remarkable for our area because she lives in Galt. Stephanie's back home from Beijing. Later today, she'll be honored by the city of Galt. Right now, she's on the phone with us, Stephanie Brown Trafton. Welcome to Insight and congratulations.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
What was it like when you came home with your gold medal?
Well, actually, I got to the airport in San Francisco. My husband and my mother-in-law, father-in-law, my dad were all waiting at the airport for me with a nice bouquet of flowers and a limo. So we got to ride in the limo back to Sacramento. That was very nice.
I bet. I've heard that this year's Olympic gold medals actually aren't entirely gold. What else is on them?
Well, the Olympic medal has one side that's pretty much always the same. It's got one of the Greek mythological figures on it. and the inscription of the Beijing Olympiad. And then the other side is always representative of the country that it's held in. And this time, the first time in history that they've used an actual stone in the medal. And it's my gold medal has a white jade ring on it.
I see. What's it like putting on the Olympic gold medal for the first time?
It's very, very amazing. It's the dream that everybody wants, every athlete wants to come to the Olympics and win a medal. And it just so happened that my gold medal was, that I had to get the gold medal. So listening to the national anthem and being on the top of the medal stand was an amazing experience.
My guest is Stephanie Brown Traft, an Olympic gold medalist in discus from Galt. When you threw your winning throw, did you know that it was good enough to win?
I did not know that it was good enough to win. I had a feeling it was good enough to get a medal, bronze, silver, maybe gold. But I did know that it was a very good throw, especially in those conditions. The air, it was pretty humid. It had just finished raining on that day. And it's a stadium, so there's no wind to kind of help the discus fly farther. So it was a very good throw under those conditions.
I'm sure all, or at least most, Olympic athletes go to the Games expecting, planning to win a medal, but not everyone has a realistic chance. How realistic did you think, when you were going there, how realistic did you think your chance was of winning a medal, and especially a gold?
I had a fairly good feeling going in that I had a chance to win a medal because I've been doing very well this year. All year long, I've been producing personal record throws, and going into the meet, I was in the top five ranked, and two of the people in the top five were not going to be at this competition. So I was pretty confident that I had the ability to win a medal. But it's, as always, you have to go through the rounds. You have to make it through the qualifying rounds, and then you have to make it into the final. So it's a lot of pressure just to make it through the rounds, and getting to the final, anything could happen. So that was my goal, is to make it to the final. And then from the final, I knew I had the ability to do it.
Your husband, as I understand, was not able to go. How did he monitor what you were doing? Because the time zone difference, 15 hours, made it pretty hard.
Right. Most of the time when California was awake and working, I was sleeping, and vice versa. So he was able to get updated on my results via NBCOlympics.com, who had live results. We were hoping that NBCOlympics.com would have live video, but it turns out they didn't have the live video. But he was able to look at the results.
You won a gold in discus, and the American track and field team did win quite a few medals, but it seemed to me like it was considered overall a disappointing performance by the U.S. track and field team this year. Was that the sense among the team?
I do sense that there was some disappointment that some of the people that were supposed to medal had disappointing performances. But at the same time, there were several people that came through with outstanding performances, like myself. And we had a sweep in the men's 400 hurdles, and we had a sweep 1-2-3 in the men's 400. So we did have some definite highlights of the meet.
Probably the two most profiled athletes in the Games were Michael Phelps, the swimmer, the American swimmer, and Usain Bolt, the Jamaican sprinter. Did you have a chance to hang around either one of them and tell us what they're actually like in person?
I didn't get a chance to really hang out with either of them, but being in the Olympic Village, we have the ability to see the people, especially with the swimmers. My apartment was in the same dorm as the swimmers, so I was able to at least rub shoulders with some of the greats.
Stephanie Brown Trafton is the Olympic gold medalist in discus from Galt. Tell us a little bit about life in the Olympic Village. I guess on the one hand, you got all these young people for the most part are going there. It's an amazing experience. You want to hang out, meet people, and maybe even party. But on the other hand, you're all athletes there for a very serious purpose. How do people manage their lives in the Olympic Village?
That's like a very good question. A lot of athletes do go there with the intention of being very focused, but then they get there and they see there's so much distraction, there's so many opportunities to, you know, get distracted with just meeting people and being social. There's, but at the same time, there are plenty of opportunities to train, and we have all the facilities that we need to get our job done there. The Olympic or the USA track and field team had a training camp that was about an hour flight from Beijing. So most of the athletes stayed at the training camp until 5 days before their event, at which time they came back to the village. So that gave a little bit of a buffer between the distraction of, you know, all of the activities that we could be doing in the Olympic Village, and the main purpose that we were there was to win medals.
The Bird's Nest Stadium was such a spectacular thing to see on TV. What's it like being in the track of the Bird's Nest Stadium when it's filled with people?
It's huge. You look up and you see you really can't see the top, almost the top row of the stands. So it can be intimidating, but at the same time, it can give you that little adrenaline rush that you need to have a great performance. So I really enjoyed being there. And in 2004, when I did not qualify for the finals, the only thing I wanted to do was go back onto the field. I just wanted to touch it. So this time I was able to get back on into the finals and get back on the field, and it was an awesome experience.
For those of us who haven't actually thrown a discus, how big is a discus? How heavy is it?
A discus weighs 2.2 pounds, 1 kilo, and I think it's about 4.5 to 5 inches in diameter. I have to look at the specs, but it's actually very light. I think people might pick it up for the first time and think it's heavy, but compared to the men's discus, the men's discus is about 4.5 pounds, so we're only half the weight.
It's amazing to me to watch discus throwers spinning round and then ending up in just the right direction, facing the right direction, and hurling this discus so far. How do you manage to keep so tight control over where you are and what you're doing, and yet at the same time unleashing this enormous energy?
It's really all about repetition in practice. You really win, you know, you win competitions in practice. And you need to be able to throw in your sleep. You need to be able to visualize yourself doing this. And after you've been doing it for 15 years like I have, it comes natural. And it pretty much the only time I feel graceful is in the discus ring. You know, I've played basketball, volleyball, and I don't feel as graceful then, but in the discus ring, everything seems to be, it's flowing and it's in one single purpose. Everything is efficient, and it's all for the purpose of chucking this thing over 200 feet.
Well, you're back to regular life. What do you do in normal life, Stephanie, when you're not an Olympic athlete?
I work at Sycamore Environmental Consultants in Sacramento as a IT analyst and working on computers with AutoCAD and GIS. And I think my coworkers are listening right now, so I have to give a shout out to all the people at Sycamore.
Are you actually back at work?
No, I will be coming in later on this week to go check some emails and say hi to all the people at work.
Are you looking forward to sitting down at your cubicle or your office or whatever?
Yes, I am. You know, we really have a tight-knit group at Sycamore, so it's a small company, family-run. So, and they're really supportive of my track and field career. And there's so much more that employers could be doing, and Sycamore is like the model of an employer that really supports their people who are, you know, Olympic aspired athletes. So, yeah. I really appreciate all their work.
And Stephanie, I read that you're going to receive the keys to the city of Galt this evening. Is that right?
As far as I know, yeah. I've been reading it in the newspaper, and so I know I'm invited. That's for sure. Yeah, we're going to be at the Galt Community Park at 7 p.m. tonight. Free nachos, free corn dogs. It's going to be an awesome time. I'll get a key to the city, lock it up in our safe.
Very good. Well, again, congratulations, Stephanie, and we appreciate you joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
That's Stephanie Brown Trafton, Olympic gold medalist in discus from Galt. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, a Zen priest explains how Homer's Odyssey is a metaphor for the spiritual path. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We welcome your suggestions of topics and guests on Insight. Send them to insight@capradio.org. One of the world's most famous archetypal stories is Homer's Odyssey. It's the story of the ancient Greek hero Odysseus's long journey home after the fall of Troy. A Northern California Zen priest has written a book making the case that Homer's Odyssey is a metaphor for the spiritual path. Norman Fisher speaks about his book, Sailing Home, in Sacramento this weekend. Right now he joins us by phone. Norman Fisher, welcome to Insight.
Hi, nice to be here.
People use the word Zen a lot, as in that's very Zen or something like that, but I suspect often without really knowing what it means. What does Zen actually mean?
Well, Zen is a school of Buddhism that came from China originally. Buddhism originated in India, as you probably know, and when it went to China, it mixed with things that China already had, like Taoism, Confucianism, and created a new school of Buddhism called Zen. And it's a pretty stripped-down, simplified, straightforward approach to religious practice. So Zen, you know, it's come to be a common word that sort of comes from the tradition, but really it's a specific religious tradition.
You are of Jewish heritage. Were you raised practicing Judaism, or were you raised in Zen Buddhism, or something else?
I was raised practicing Judaism. I was from a conservative, one of the denominations of Judaism, conservative Judaism, and we were observant. And I discovered Zen in my early 20s at a time when the whole Western world was discovering Zen, because when I was a little boy, there was virtually no such thing in the West.
So what brought you to Zen Buddhism? What was it about Zen Buddhism that spoke to you so profoundly?
Well, it was mostly the philosophy. I was always interested in philosophy and religious thought, and when I was in college, I studied philosophy and religion, and in the course of that study, I ran into the first books that were being published in English about Zen Buddhism, and they just seemed to answer the kind of questions that I had philosophically, so I right away said, this is it.
My guest is Norman Fisher, Zen Buddhist abbot and author of Sailing Home, a new book that uses Homer's Odyssey as a metaphor for the spiritual path. Why did you decide to study and write about Homer's Odyssey?
Well, it mostly came out of my teaching. I was reading the Odyssey. I really enjoy it, and I read it now and then. And I have been giving Zen lectures at a retreat, and I just happened to throw in some metaphors from the Odyssey, and people really responded to it. And I kept doing it in a few other lectures, and before I knew it, I was really onto something and recognizing how much it resonated with people's real lives. Because most religious texts, you know, are about founders of religions who are usually pretty saintly characters, and most of us who are trying to practice religion are not so saintly. So neither is Odysseus. You know, Odysseus has lots of problems and makes mistakes and gets discouraged, and I think that my listeners who were trying to practice Zen with me could really relate to Odysseus as a character in a way much more than they could relate to the kind of purity and lofty religiosity of the Buddha.
It's such an old story. Why do you think it, more than just about anything else that was written so long ago, is still with us today?
Well, I think that's it. I think I stumbled into something that without realizing it. I mean, I think that although, of course, the Odyssey is an adventure story, I think it stays with us so long because somehow we know that it's really telling us a lot of really important stuff about the inner life, about our spiritual journey home. After all, we're all trying to come home. That's a great way to look at the spiritual life, just to come home. To come home to the heart, to come home to the present moment, to come home to family, to come home to death and the end of life. And so I think that even though it's possible that I'm the first one to do an entirely spiritual path reading of the Odyssey, I think that everybody has realized all along that that there is this feeling within the Odyssey that's been relevant to readers from the beginning up to the present.
Is your book Sailing Home written from a Zen Buddhist perspective, or is it from a more general spiritual perspective?
It's from a more general perspective. I have had significant spiritual practice in Judaism, not only in my youth, but as an adult. I'm involved now with Jewish meditation. My colleague, Rabbi Alan Liu, and I have a Jewish meditation center in San Francisco, and I travel here and there with Jewish meditation. I've also practiced in Christian monasteries. So, and I read a lot in world spiritual literature. So, so the book covers all of that. Now, to be sure, I've spent my life in Zen Buddhist practice, so that's the main place I'm coming from, and I'm not trying to pass myself off as an expert on world religions, but I do reference many other things, and I'm really speaking to spiritual practitioners from any religious tradition, or people who are not part of any religious tradition at all, but consider themselves to be secular, but interested in these matters. So that's my who the book is addressed to.
Norman Fisher is the author of Sailing Home, a book that uses Homer's Odyssey as a metaphor for the spiritual path. He speaks this Saturday evening at Time Tested Books in Sacramento. You recently wrote an article for O, the Oprah magazine. How did that come about? Do you know Oprah Winfrey?
No, I don't. I don't. Again, that came about also kind of by chance. I was doing an event on that same subject called The One Who's Not Busy, How to Maintain a Peaceful Mind in the Midst of a Busy Life, because there's an ancient Zen story about that topic. So I was doing a day-long retreat on that at Spirit Rock Meditation Center up here in Northern California, and somehow or other, Oprah's people heard about this, and they contacted me, and they said, could you write us something on that topic? We heard it was a really nice day, so I did.
The one who's not busy might, in fact, be a busy person. How do you remain not busy amid all the responsibilities in life?
Well, I think that when you're centered in time and in space, meaning space, be your own body, your own where you are, you can move through your day paying attention to what you're doing, doing one thing after another. You're always only ever doing one thing, and you do that one thing thoroughly, and when it's over, you do something else. So it really doesn't make any difference how many things there are going on. You just do what you can, and when the day ends, you go to bed.
Many people become centered by meditating or doing something similar, but that's all very well at the beginning or the end of the day, but during the day, how do you stay centered?
Well, first of all, if you have a regular practice, it influences the way you are all day long. But when you practice meditation regularly, you begin to see how many opportunities there are during the day for a brief meditation break. And it becomes quite natural. For instance, for me, whenever I'm walking anywhere, it's a meditation break. Even if I'm just walking to the bathroom, when I stand up, I notice that I'm standing up from my chair. When I walk, I notice I'm walking. Anytime I'm doing anything, I pay attention to what I'm doing, and everything is a time of returning to myself. So, you know, it's not hard to practice meditation in daily activity during the whole of the day.
And as a Zen Buddhist priest, what does that mean for your everyday life and for the way you present yourself to the world? Would people know that you're a Zen Buddhist priest?
Not necessarily. In America, Zen Buddhist priests don't necessarily wear priestly clothing all the time. So I do wear Buddhist robes when I'm in retreats and when I'm teaching and when I'm in a temple. But at home, I don't. And there are some Zen Buddhist priests who do wear informal priest robes all the time. I don't. So if you saw me walking down the street, you probably wouldn't notice me as a clergy person.
I see. Well, Norman Fisher, Zen Buddhist and author of Sailing Home, a new book that uses Homer's Odyssey as a metaphor for the spiritual path. He speaks this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. at Time Tested Books in Midtown Sacramento. Norman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Coming up on KXJZ, a U.S. sports organization will soon require its members to pass an English proficiency test. The LPGA says this will help its golf players better interact with fans and sponsors. Plus, concerns about possible recession in Germany, the world's third largest economy. Those stories and the rest of the day's business news next on Marketplace. Today's associate producer was Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The assistant producer is Robin Souza. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. The Democratic National Convention wraps up this week in Denver. On the next Insight, we'll talk with a local photojournalist covering it. Also, a UC Davis professor is one of two recipients of the Rome Prize in Musical Composition. Kurt Rode tells you about winning this prestigious award. And Sacramento's fastest chihuahua competes for the world title. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
tomorrow afternoon at 2 on KXJZ.